mindfulness as part of the five faculties. And this is a third week in a series of talks, and I'll talk a little bit about the whole series. The five faculties is one of the Buddha's lists. He gave us a lot of lists that lump together things so that we can consider, the faculties, here are things that facilitate our practice. This is one of them. The list is faith or confidence. It's effort or perseverance, mindfulness, which we'll talk about tonight, and in coming weeks you'll hear about concentration and discernment or wisdom. And, if I didn't say mindfulness in there, I said paying attention. You could take that list and say, well, I could use this for anything. This could make me a better musician or make me a better software engineer or something like that. And indeed, there's a lot in this list. I mean, what that points to is there's some commonalities in this list that just make it that we use for any time we want to get better at a skill. And they say, meditation's a skill. I can learn that. There are things I can pay attention to. I can get beyond sitting down and hoping for the best, which is right. I spent long enough doing that. I mean, just isn't that a nice thought that maybe there's hope? So we're going to talk a little. So the Buddha gave us this list. In fact, it was so important he gave it to us twice. The first time is the five faculties. That's folks like us. We're just working on them, strengthening them. He gives the same list and calls them the five strengths for senior students or his disciples when they're mature. So he only gave out so many lists, and this one he gave out twice. So we could use the five faculties and talk about anything, riding bikes, whatever. So I'm just going to go through this, the whole list, as though I were talking about some ordinary skill, like riding a bike or whatever. And so I have to do this as Lance Armstrong, because I really enjoyed this. Here's the guy, he had metastasized cancer, and he came back to beat that and every other bicyclist in the world. I just think that's just amazing. So how would Lance Armstrong talk about this? I'm just going to try this. So he says, okay, if you want to get better at riding a bike, and not winning races, whatever, just get better at riding a bike and not taking the bike out for riding a Sunday, but actually pushing yourself a little bit, there are five things you got to do. And they have nothing to do with a bike or fancy clothes. There are five things you all have. They don't cost you anything. What you have to do is you have to identify what they are, and you have to nurture them. The first one is you got to have faith. You got to believe. And I mean that in a special way. First, you got to believe that this is worth doing. It's far too hard to be a hobby. If you're going to push yourself and do what's required, you have to believe that it's going to make a difference. You can't know the fruits of the practice yet, but you probably have some idea that you really want to do this, lose 15 pounds, be free from suffering, whatever it is. You have to have confidence that that you have some drive that's going to sustain you. Secondly, you got to find a coach and a training program to stick with. Don't change training programs every time you pick up a bicycle magazine, or you never get anywhere. Stick with it. Find something you can stick with for 2 years. Why? Because in 2 years, you're going to have some bad times, and you're going to have some good times, and you're going to see the upside of the training, and you're going to see if the training can get you through the low times. So find something you can stick with. And finally, you got to have confidence in yourself. This is not superhuman effort. There's nothing like that. This is just confidence that you can do some fairly mundane things over and over again. Getting out of bed early on a rainy Saturday morning. Staying with it. Making the choices that are necessary to continue practice. The second thing you got to do is you got to have energy and perseverance. Some of that's just plain physical energy. You got to get a good night's sleep if you're going to practice. Some of it's energy to stick with a training ride until the end. Some of it's perseverance. You have to do this. You have to do this 5 days a week, every week for the next couple of years. You just have to stick with it. There's nothing here that you can't do. You'll just get better at it as you go along. The important thing is to pick off something you can bite off and chew, and continue with it. You'll just get better as you go. Third thing you need to do is you need to pay attention to what's important. when you're riding the bike, if you're riding the bike seriously and you're looking at the trees and all that, you're going to lose your focus and you're not going to go anywhere. You have to pay attention to your own condition. Are you getting hydrated? How's your pace going? Pay attention to the riders and the road. Pay attention to those things. You're also going to need concentration. You're going to need to stay with it. And I don't mean concentration just in the mind. I mean it in the body too, because concentration's a mind and a body thing. You're going to fall into your groove. You're going to know when that happens. Learn what it feels like to be in the groove. Find you and know how to find your way back there. You're going to have to bring everything you got to what's important for the period of your ride. And the last thing you need to do is get some discernment. You're going to pull a groin muscle, and you're going to have to decide whether you're going to get in the bike and train through it, or whether you're going to take a weekend off. And there's no answer you can know ahead of time. You're just going to have to make good decisions. The way you make good decisions is you catch yourself making bad decisions. So pay attention to what you do, and do more of the good stuff and less of the bad stuff. Another thing that helps is to find other people that already make good decisions and hang around them. Find out if they know something that you don't, if they have different values that you do. Find out how they react when they make a bad decision, and find out how they use good decisions. Find those people and hang around them. Those are the five things you got to do. Okay, so end of Lance. Okay, I just had to do that. So now I want to talk about the list. So that's kind of like you can use it for anything. I mean, people talk about high performance athletes or surgeons, whatever, and they find them talking about these same things. Maybe not by the same numbers, but same qualities there. But when we look at these things in terms of our meditation, they take on a special meaning. And mindfulness, which is what we're going to talk on tonight, is kind of a word that you don't really hear outside of the practice. So it's kind of a clue there. First I want to talk a little bit about to get everybody on the same page about what we mean by mindfulness. And we all know what it is to some extent or another. We've all caught ourselves just about to say something really stupid, and we said, "Oh, I'm not going to go there," right? And that was just a moment of mindfulness where you just caught yourself. You didn't get caught up in the story or your reactions or your feelings about yourself, how important you were, how poor you were, whatever, all of that stuff. You just paid attention to what was going on, and that was mindfulness right there, without the stories and the preconceptions and stuff. In fact, there's now a unit of measure for mindfulness. It's called the Ono second. And the Ono second, as you probably already heard, is the amount of time it takes you to say, between when you say something stupid and you realize what you just said. So that's an Ono second. And there's lots of clinical evidence that when your mindfulness is shorter than one Ono second, then you make a lot of mistakes. So in a way, mindfulness can help us practicing it in daily life, can help us bring mindfulness above that one Ono second threshold. And when we get to stretch it together, we string these things together in our meditation settings to the point where they're two breaths, three breaths, four breaths long. Then we can see even deeper, and we can get even more stuff. So I'm going to tell you my kind of naive theory of the mind. It's nobody else's theory. It's just mine. But you may find out that makes some sense to you. For a lot of us, the life of the mind is this continuous, if fairly turbulent, stream of thoughts and reactions and wants and dislikes and preconceptions, along with our internal spin doctor that keeps on retelling every story all the time so that we come out the way that we need to come out. Okay, that's what I'm going to call the conventional layer of thought, because that's the only word I could come up with right now. And I'm even going to include in that conventional layer of thought what we normally call subconscious, because even though we might not be able to track it thought by thought, it's made up of the same kind of materials. There's me, and there's want, and there's mine, and there's now, and there's all of those things in there. And if that's your mental life, and that's the universe, that's the material you've got to play with, what you're probably going to do if you want to solve a problem, if you want to reduce suffering or something, is play with those concepts and constructs and maybe come up with a better system better philosophical system or a better ethical system. You may want to rearrange your ideology or come up with lots of different things. But in a way, that's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, because you're not really getting down below that to what the Buddha was pointing to. And that's where we can see with mindfulness. And that's, we get to see the same things, but without the additions of the mind. The fact that the mind insists on telling everything in terms of, in first person, in terms of me. The fact that we may be afraid of something. The fact that we may want something or be angry about something. I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting something or being afraid of the right things. But those are so tangled, on one level there's nothing wrong, but those are so tangled up in this conventional layer of consciousness that the game is fixed. There's just, those things aren't necessary, a necessary part of living life, but as long as they're there, suffering is inevitable. And we're not going to, I think what the Buddha was pointing to is we're not going to get out of those things if we just try and rearrange our concepts and stuff. We have to get underneath that and free ourselves from all of that. And that's where mindfulness is going. That's where mindfulness wants to take us. So, for example, if you burn your finger on a stove, and you say, ouch, boy, that was stupid, now I'm going to get a blister, you know? Well, how much of that was in the thought itself? I mean, in the experience, you know, like, oh, I was stupid, well, that's probably an addition. And now I'm going to get a blister, that's an addition. And, oh, my finger, well, was that an addition? Or, I mean, is that a necessary part of it or not? I mean, ouch, where did this come from? You know, we can make some guesses about what to throw out and what to keep, but unless we can see the initial event where we actually hurt our finger, we're not going to know for sure. And, you know, I could tell you what I think it is, or I could tell you what other people thought the answer was, but that doesn't matter, because then that would just be a conventional belief that you would accept. What's important is that we each get to look for ourselves and make up our own mind. People that do that often come up with the same conclusion, but it's important that we each have ourselves. So there's mindfulness is this clear seeing aspect where we would, for example, look at the pain of touching the stove or pain in our legs or something, and we can kind of distance ourselves from our immediate reactions to it. We may be able to see pain as pressure and movement and heat. And in a way, the pain, if we drop into some mindfulness, the pain can actually seem like, well, there's just pain there, and it might not even be my pain. I can observe it exquisitely, I mean, with exquisite detail, but I don't have to get caught up in the fact that this is my pain. It may still hurt. I mean, that's a physiological thing, right? The nociceptors, whatever, the pain receptors and all that. I mean, that's physiology. You're going to have that. But if you look at it close enough, you can find out that the physiological reaction to pain stimulus is different from your psychological aversion to it. And you may actually find out that the psychological aversion hurts more than the pain itself. But you got to see that. I mean, and the fact is, you can see that if you get down below this level of conventional mindfulness, or conventional consciousness. And so, when you see one of these things, when you get an insight like this about saying, "Ah, the thing that really bothered me was my aversion to the pain, and not the pain itself." When you get one of those things, it's a little bit like an intuition, because it comes all at once. I mean, there's no like lead up to it, no drum roll. There's no, like, it's not like long division where you finally get the answer. It just comes like that. It's probably not about what you were thinking about. That's why it's an insight rather than a conclusion. It's like, oh my gosh, I never thought of that. And it probably has some immediate, some in your bones immediacy about it. That makes it, I mean, it's yours. You know, Gil could get up here and talk to you for 45 minutes about how that's wrong. I said, I'm sorry, Gil. That's just, I know it. I saw it for myself. And nobody can take it away from you. And so that's what this insight stuff is about. So that's that part right there is often what we talk, you know, when we talk about insight or mindfulness, we're often talking about that part right there. But there's another aspect of mindfulness, which is actually remembering to do some things. And in the first place, it's remembering what it is that's skillful. And you say, no, wait a second. I thought we were just supposed to, you know, go with the flow here and pay attention to what was happening, right? We've all heard that. But, and what about this choiceless awareness stuff? Wasn't this supposed to be choiceless awareness? Well, no, I mean, maybe, but not really. The Buddha gave us a lot of lists of ways to pay attention to things. In fact, some things that are better to pay attention to than others. When we started the evening, we talked about paying attention to the breath. For example, that's part of developing mindfulness would be to pay attention to the breath. What there are is skillful ways to pay attention to various things. So, for example, if I get angry, I make it, you know, I don't say, I am angry, darn right I'm angry, and what's more, let me tell you about the time before that, too. You know, that's not mindfulness. Pretty soon we're just gone. We've lost it. So the clue is, oh, I am angry. What happened there is I was buying into the story, I was reinforcing the story. So instead of getting into the, you know, reinforcing the content, just say anger, anger, anger. And that kind of depersonalizes it. So that's one of the ways that we make a choice for how to pay skillful attention. So mind, and part of that is remembering to do that. When we get angry, it's remembering, oh, I don't have to stay here and rehearse the story. I mean, how many times have I told myself a story about something? I mean, if I had a friend who told me the same story as often as I talk to myself, I'd never talk to him again. Right? It's but it's, you know. So that's part of it. And perhaps, I said I didn't really like choiceless awareness for the reason that I mentioned, at least from my experience. Another word that might be better is non-reactive awareness. So when we say non-reactive awareness, the non-reactive part, we kind of get rid of the knee-jerk aspect. Sometimes, you know, we're pulling into traffic and also we have to change lanes. We need to react. But sometimes we react when we really shouldn't, when we really should be responding. So the non-reactive awareness is where you can actually look at something and you can see something come up that you don't necessarily like, and you don't pull out all the old stories or defense mechanisms and pile hurt on hurt and stuff. That's just reacting out of habit, and there's nothing fresh about that. And as long as we reinforce that, we're just gonna live the same stuff over and over and over again. But if you can look at it with this non-reactive way, that opens the way to responsiveness, and that can come from a deeper, broader, more stable place. And that's where mindfulness kind of touches base with discernment, which is one of the other faculties here. It's not the same thing, but mindfulness can feed into discernment by letting us see things as they really are, rather than rehearsing our old stories about them. And then there's another aspect of this remembering part of mindfulness, and that's just plain remembering to do it. Not, you know, Gil often says, you know, mindfulness isn't that hard. Remembering to do it is, and there's a lot to that. The part of mindfulness where we have to remember to pull ourselves away. Oh, don't get involved in the anger. That's one of my favorite tar babies. I mean, I can just get caught in anger and not come out for a long time, so I'm better off not touching it. So, but I have to you know, distance myself from it. So there's that parts that we talked about remembering. Oh, you know, I'm supposed to be mindful now, and oh, here's the way that I can handle this. Those are some of the, those can be hard. You know, we're constantly kind of pulling ourselves back. That's all good stuff. That's part of mindfulness, and it's one of the things where we can actually apply our will to it. But the actual mindfulness itself, when we're just kind of in the zone and we're looking at things, that takes care of itself. I mean, if you're actually mindful and you're paying attention and you try and get a little bit more, you said, oh, I'm not seeing enough here. I'll strain a little bit harder and I'll get some more insight or something. It just backfires on you. That part of it you can't push. That part of this, yeah, the bad part of it is you can't push it. It matures. The good part of it is when it matures, it's strong enough that it can protect you. You can even get to the point where if the first parts of mindfulness are like, you know, trying to learn how to ride a bike, and you take a few steps and you fall off, and you take a pedal a little bit and you fall, and keep on getting back on. You can get to a point where it's like riding with no hands, because you just can't, it's almost like you can't fall off. And you know, often that's on a retreat or something like that. And that aspect of mindfulness can be very, not only very pleasurable, but very safe. Because you can realize that when you're there, all kinds of nasty stuff can come up. I mean, you can see stuff about yourself that if your best friend told you, you'd be over with. You can see stuff about yourself, and because you've kind of put your self-story and all these other things on hold for a while, you can look at it and say, boy, I was a real jerk. You know, you can say that honestly to yourself without beating yourself up and still feel good about the fact that you got settled enough to be able to look at yourself honestly. And there's kind of a protection there. And you know, that's where there's a real strength there. And that's kind of where one place where mindfulness touches base with faith or confidence. Because once you realize that mindfulness can get you through something, it won't change it, make it better. It'll just make you be able to handle it better. You say, oh, that's cool. You know, it's not whether I just got a raise or I got a new car or whatever. There's just this thing inside me. I don't have to earn it. It's just here. I can call it up sometimes, and it's here, and it seems to protect me. And that's you know, that kind of leads into faith. And then you say, well, maybe I'll try and sit a little bit longer. You know, next time I feel like getting up, I think I'm just going to stay here and see if I can see if that same stuff will get me through. So there's this feedback loop, and that's kind of how the faculties kind of support each other and play with each other. So I want to talk about a couple of the other faculties. Particularly, I want to talk about mindfulness and concentration. Concentration is going to be the next one, but I'm going to talk about them both tonight. Partly because Vipassana isn't really just mindfulness. We sometimes call it mindfulness meditation, but it's really mindfulness and concentration. It's like a skillful mix put together. So we've got fuchsias in our yard. We've got this grape. We've got them up along the fence, and just wall of red and purple and all that. We've got these hummingbirds that just come around. It's, you know, this kind of zzz, and they hover right there in front of a flower, and they taste some of the nectar, and then zip right like this, over to the next one, and zip, zip, zip. And so I want to talk about. Use hummingbirds to talk about mindfulness and concentration. So it's an image, don't take it too far, but maybe we can have some fun with it. So when a hummingbird flies up to a flower, and he's paying attention to that particular red flower, not to this one or that one, but to this particular red flower, that's kind of like concentration. He's right there. He's rock steady. If you've ever watched a hummingbird, he's kind of like, nah, he's right there. And then when the hummingbird actually tastes the nectar and knows firsthand what that flower is like, that's like mindfulness. So actually in this kind of metaphor, the hummingbird's kind of has Vipassana all down. He's got it down. If the hummingbird were to, you know, race past the fuchsias and try and grab a little bit of nectar in each flower as you went along, he wouldn't get any. And that's how a lot of us, how I live a lot of my life, is I'm not concentrated or mindful. I'm just bouncing from one phone call, the email, to this, to that, to my reaction to this habitual like or dislike. That's just kind of what it's like. But if we can do what the hummingbird does, then we can develop our concentration. Now, if the hummingbird were to hang out in front of the same flower for 45 minutes, without tasting it, that would be really deep concentration, but it wouldn't be vipassana. People that are really good at concentration tell me that it's amazing stuff. It's very, very, very pleasant. It's quite powerful. But since you're looking at the same flower all the time, you're not seeing how things change. And without seeing how things change, you're not seeing how they really are. And without seeing how they really are, you can't get under that layer of conventional consciousness and free yourself from all the problems that are kind of tangled up in there. So concentration is important. The Buddha has right concentration in the Eightfold Path right along with right mindfulness. But it's the Buddha added right mindfulness to that because concentration by itself wasn't enough. And there are different ways to add concentration and mindfulness together. And in the style of Vipassana we teach here, this is kind of like hummingbird Vipassana. So there's a little bit of momentary concentration on each flower and dipping into the flower. And then there's momentary concentration on the next thing and dipping into the flower. So rather than steady concentration like developing an absorption or working with a mantra or something like that, there's just concentration on each little bit and then at that same time tasting the flower to see what's going on. Now, sometimes if a hummingbird were just to fly from flower to flower and not dip in and taste anything, that would kind of like being concentrated without really being mindful. So that might be, for example, just being mechanical with the breath and saying in and out or rising, falling, and paying attention to the words and not to the physical sensation. When you get into concepts and you pay attention to concepts, then you can get into concentration, which is really good. And so there's kind of a dividing line there. If you lose sight of the physical sensation of the breath and and the in, out, rising, falling becomes like a mantra, then you can get concentrated, but you're not necessarily paying attention in a mindful way. And that, does that make any sense to people? Does that make sense about, oh my gosh, that's what happened? Yeah, okay. So that's why we're talking about these distinctions. So I want to talk about a few more distinctions like that and then introduce the special aspect that mindfulness has in the five faculties. It's kind of like it has a role to play on its own, but it's also, if the five faculties are a team, mindfulness is kind of like a player coach or the team captain. So if somebody's hogging the ball, so concentration, you know, share the ball, you know, give it to somebody else. Or somebody's been missing some practices or just having a bad day, and kind of buck them up, you know, hey, effort, come on, let's, show up. We really need you right now. So it's not like superstars or anything. Everybody has their assigned role, their position, they play that. And mindfulness is kind of there to try and keep things balanced. And some of the things that need balanced most often are mindfulness, effort, and concentration. And I mean, there are a lot of things that can happen when you're meditating. I'd like to spend the last 10 minutes or so talking about two problems that, if you haven't had them yet, you probably have them. You know, just wait. And the two problems are either that you're just too jumpy and too antsy and you can't settle down, or the other one is you're just too loggy and too sleepy and you just can't put it together. I mean, if you're full of sensual desire, which can be thinking about lunch or apple pie or anything, or you're full of anger or you're full of doubt. Those are other those are other legitimate problems, but we're going to talk about these two right here. And I'm going to throw out a lot of stuff, but the important thing is that you there's a way to look at your practice and actually figure out what some of the problems are and try and help yourself. And you can learn how to do that. You probably already have a lot of the pieces. So let's take the first example is, let's say we're scattered and jumpy. You're not caught up in anger or anything. It's just like you're bouncing off the walls. Well, the first thing you have to do before you can solve a problem is to recognize that it's a problem. And a lot of times I sit down and bounce off the walls. And I say, oh, that's just it. I'm just bouncing off the walls, you know. No, that's a problem, and we can fix it. It may be that, you know, you're trying to meditate and you're saying, gee, I got to get the kids up. I have to fix some breakfast and make lunch to get them to the bus. And, you know, maybe the best thing is just to get up and address the problem and make lunch the evening before or the next time or something. You know, not everything is you can fix by adjusting the faculties. Sometimes there are real things you got to get done. Let's see, what is it? But if we can, let's see. But sometimes we have this bounciness right at the beginning, and we think, okay, we're going to get through this. But how do I do it? And it's right at the beginning of a meditation. You really haven't developed any meditation at all. You just kind of sat down and you're distracted. Well, this may be one of the five hindrances, which is another one of the Buddha's lists. Of the kind of like the top five suspects that get every meditator, and they make your meditation hard. And one of the reasons that they make the meditation hard is that they fool you into thinking that there's no problem, and what they're really doing is really important stuff, like bouncing off walls or whatever, or thinking about what you should be doing or something. So if it's happening early in the meditation and you haven't it may be this restlessness and remorse. And, you know, maybe here you're just restless because you got to get the kids to school, you're worried about something you said to somebody yesterday. But if it isn't that, I mean, or maybe it is, or you still want to work through it, then what you need to do is get your mind settled down and your body settled down too, and you can do that with more concentration. So maybe you count some breaths, you know, concepts, if that's okay. Maybe you count backwards from 10 to 1. I know that when I count from 1 to 10, I often end up at 12 or 13. When I count backwards, it's a little harder, and I usually stop at 1. So try that a few times, and you'd be surprised how quickly you drift off. And you go 10, 9, 8, 10, 9, 8, 7. By the time you can, but when you can do that for a bit, and this is something that's, yeah, it's not terribly subtle. It may not be, maybe hard, but it's not terribly subtle. You can do this even when you're kind of scattered, and again and again and again until you get better. And by the time you get to 20 or something like that, you may be settled. Your mind may be settled, and your body may be more, maybe happier, more settled, and then you can try your meditation again. So that's one thing. Now, let's suppose that you've been meditating for a half an hour or something like that, and you know, you've actually been mindful, and you find yourself anxious. You know, what's this going on? I want to squirm or get up or something like that. Well, what may have happened is what happens to me is I'll be very, very. I'll have a lot of some mindfulness, some concentration going, and mindfulness. I'll get fairly concentrated. The body gets really, really. I'll get fairly concentrated, and maybe the breath gets very, very soft, and I kind of lose contact with the physical sensation, and maybe I'm paying attention to things, but I'm not getting all these insights that I got yesterday, right? So I'm going to push a little bit more, and say, I know, I'm going to breathe just a little bit harder, right? Just I'll push it just a little bit. They say not to, but I can get away with it. Just a little bit. And what happens, you start hyperventilating ever so much, and after that, you get anxious, and you get flighty, and you get bumpy. And what you need there is not more effort at breathing or something like that. You just kind of, you need less. Yeah, so maybe you just have to back off and live with the fact that, you know, that your mindfulness is, that's the way it's going to be for right now. It's not going to be these, you know, one insight after another. It's just maybe you're going to lose, the breath is going to get so small that all you can do is say knowing, 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 instead of rising, you know, instead of actually touching with the physical sensation. But that's part of it. I mean, you're in that area where, at least as far as my experience, where you can't push it. You gotta kind of give it its head. You gotta let the mindfulness do what it has to do on its own. It's smarter than you are. You gotta trust it, and it'll do it. So then there's the opposite problem where you are just falling asleep, or you're just tired or drifting, whatever. And it may be another one of those hindrances, sloth and torpor. And sloth and torpor means your heart's not into it and your body's not up to it. And maybe you're just tired. You know, if you got to bed late last night, it's Friday, you've had a long week, whatever. You know, some of these things you're just gonna meditate later or rearrange your schedule or whatever. You're not gonna get around them with adjusting the faculties. Maybe you need some inspiration. Maybe you can think of a talk. You say, oh boy, that last talk Gil gave was just so great. Or maybe I'm at the age where my peers are dying. And that kind of adds some immediacy to things. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, this isn't a game. You know, this used to be, you know, this is, I mean, this goes way beyond personal improvement. I mean, this starts to get important. You know, maybe, you know, not to get maudlin or spooky about it, but, you know, if that works for you to think about the urgency of it, you know, try it. If it doesn't, try something else. So maybe it's this sloth and torpor. And often what you need to do there is try and find a way to get interested in your meditation. Try and find something to get interested in. Maybe you can get interested in what it feels like to feel sleepy. Now, here's one for you. I know what it feels like to get angry. I know where it is. I know what it's like to feel afraid. I know where that feels in my body. But where do I get sleepy? Is it my eyelids or whatever? I haven't figured that one out. I mean, maybe you can. Maybe you get interested in that one. The kind of when we fall prey to sloth and torpor is because we think that we don't have the energy to put the effort in. And actually, it can work the other way around, is that effort can create energy. If you can just find a way to start getting interested in something, you may find out that you have more energy than you thought, and you can kind of work through that. Then the other aspect of it is, maybe this is later in your meditation, okay? And you're there, and things are going well, and then you just kind of start to drift. And what might be happening here is you really were, in fact, developing both mindfulness and concentration, but your concentration got a little bit ahead of your mindfulness. And when that happens, the body can get very, very comfortable. It's very, very pleasant. And you can just kind of drift. And instead of dipping into the flower all the time, you can switch over to more and more concentration. So you need to reestablish the balance between mindfulness and concentration. And so what you can try to do is give yourself more objects, another object to be mindful of. You really can't push the mindfulness, right? But you can give yourself another object. So if the breath is really slow, there's the rising, falling, big space there, rising, falling. In between the out-breath and the next in-breath, give yourself another touch point. It can be your sits bones and the pillow. It can be your lips together, your hands in your lap. Or it may just be a quick, just all at once, gestalt about your posture. Are you slumping or not? I mean, not a body scan, but just like, you know. So it might go rising, falling, touching, rising, falling, sitting, like that. So now you have three things. So instead of like rising, falling, and then nothing happens for a while, and then you're gone. You know, you're not around for the in-breath. Give yourself a way station there so that you've got something to keep your mind busy all the time. And then as maybe you can re-engage the mind and the mindfulness and go on and do that. So I just wanted to give a recap here. I said a lot, but if you were going to try and what I'd like you to consider taking home with you is a few things here. The first is mindfulness is the clear seeing. It's dropping down below this conventional layer of reality, because it's only there that we get a chance to explore things without all the preconceptions and the I stories and our hates and our wants and stuff that really keep us miserable. And that aspect of mindfulness, when you get it, it seems to me anyway, that you kind of have to let that mature on its own. When it does, it can be very strong, but it's not part of the practice you can push. Like if you're not happy with how, you know, your insights or something, don't go hunting for them. They'll come to you. You don't know what they'll look like. How can you go hunting for them? But I do all the time, right? Oh, I need to go. I'll try just a little bit harder. No, that's the part where you got to, okay, the best thing to do is just kind of sit back and let the mindfulness develop itself. And then there's mindfulness is remembering the fact that we need to be mindful in the first place, and then remembering the skillful ways to pay attention and differentiating those from the unskillful ways. And then the last one is making your own meditation, making your meditation an object of itself. You can check in on your own meditation as part of your meditation. Are you sleepy? Are you mindful? Are you concentrated? You can look at these things. The Buddha talks about these things in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. He goes down the hindrances. He goes down, are you mindful? Are you investigating qualities? Are you concentrated? He asks you to look at exactly these things that allow us to kind of be custodians of our own meditation. So consider that, the fact that your mindfulness can be, your meditation can be its own object, and play with it. See if you... at least track the results of your own meditation, and try and get some experience with what works. Try titrating your concentration or your mindfulness. If you make a mistake, you'll find out about it right away, and it's no worse than just letting things happen by themselves, and you might learn something. So that's what I wanted to leave you with tonight. Thank you for coming, and I would... like to discuss this, or I mean, maybe you've got experiences of your own, or things you want to mention, or there's a question that I might have an answer for, somebody else might have an answer for. So, oh, I'm sorry. Yes, thank you.
So you talked. I love your analogy of the tar baby. You know, and how anger you kind of get more and more stuck on it.
Yeah.
If you're trying to support someone who is in the tar baby situation, how do you do that?
I understand your question. I think that maybe the first thing to do, and maybe this is all you can get to, certainly is for me sometimes when I'm in a situation like that, is just to watch my own reactions and try not to get wrapped up with them about that. Like especially if you're a recovering anger-holic or something like that, if you're a recovering angerholic, or at least trying to become a recovering angerholic, and somebody else is getting off on anger, it kind of hurts. It used to be so much fun to say, let's talk. I'll match you bitch for bitch, right? Yeah, but you see what happens often enough, and it's kind of like this aversion therapy. It's not. I wish it were less quick like that, but it's this aversion therapy. But after you've been through it enough, it's hard to see somebody else doing it, I think. And when I get in a situation like that, I just have to spend all my time making sure that I'm not making the situation worse. I don't know how to make it better for them. I wish I did, but that's... Is that kind of the question?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I wish I had a silver bullet. I mean, somebody else may.
No, it's easy if it's not a loved one, but if it is a loved one, you can't walk away because that feeds their anger.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right.
It's like a no-win situation.
Right. Right. You've got to be there, and on one hand you feel like you're enabling their anger, and on another hand, if you try and bring it up, you just do something, they can just blow up and make it worse. I think I understand your situation, and really the only thing I found is in situations like that is I just have to try and make sure that I'm not making things worse, and then getting angry about how angry they are or something like that and reverting to my old habits or reinforcing my current ones or whatever. Great question. Anybody else? I mean, somebody else has dealt with this? They have a better answer? How was the meditation tonight? Some of you were doing it at least here for the first or second time. Did that make any questions come up? You say, why are we doing this or whatever? I mean, did that?
I do have a question about boredom. Actually, I don't know if that falls in the torpor category,
mm-hmm.
but I find after 20, 30 minutes, I just get really, really bored and. Boredom is worse to watch than the breath. It's even more boring. And so I find I attach to any little sound. Oh, an airplane, thank God. Watch your anger. Even the creaking of the floor becomes entertaining. I'm reaching out for anything. So what do we do about that?
Yeah, well, with any of these things, sometimes you just have to notice that. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, that may be your part. You may be in a phase where that's just part of your meditation, and just noticing what the boredom is part of it. I mean, some things we can change, some things we can't. But sometimes it may be that you're bored because you've kind of lost a little bit of the contact with mindfulness or something, and you just because there's plenty of things that are going on, and maybe you can find something that maybe you can get interested in again, like the sensations in your legs. There's a lot of stuff going on there. Maybe you can just kind of pay attention to that, get interested in that. Something that doesn't involve a story or whatever, but where there's enough change going on so that it's interesting. Or maybe you've been trying this. Pay extra attention to your breath, or like I mentioned, at a touch point, something like that. Those are things that generally just try to find a way to get interested in your meditation again. That's the best advice I have. And there are some things you can do, especially if you've been dropping a little bit of the mindfulness along the way. You might some things you can do to get more interested in it again. I don't know if it's going to help, but it's a tough one. I mean, especially if you're sitting for half an hour, whatever. Yeah. Well, often that's because we're thinking about something else. We've got this idea. Huh?
I find my thoughts
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's actually in the Buddhist scheme of things, there are six senses, and the sixth one is the mind. And it's real easy to get just, you know, attached, you know, to, you love to read or solve problems, puzzles, crosswords, or whatever, and you can get really into that. And that can be as addictive and distracting as food or anything else. I don't have a better answer than what I already gave you. Sorry. Please.
Not real knowledgeable about formal meditation practice, but I'm curious, as much of it seems just internally focused and attending to what's going on inside. And I'm just wondering if the Buddha ever talked about when you're in a collective setting, attending to the collective experience.
There are phrases where the Buddha talks about paying attention to the body and the body internally and then externally and then internally and externally. And some people think that he's talking about, especially like in daily life or something like that, paying attention to what other people, the posture of other people or something like that. I'm not convinced that's what he was talking about, and maybe you can tell me more about what you mean by external setting.
Well, I've been trying to pick my way through Aurobindo a little bit. He seems to talk about this next level of consciousness. It's more of a collective, unified. You know, we're all one kind of thing. So it seems like in some sense that might involve trying to get a sense of collectively as a single entity.
I see what you're saying. People talk about that, and this is very opinionated, and it's my opinion right here. A lot of people talk about it and say the Buddha said we're all one, and in the Pali Canon he never said that. I mean, he was very good at saying things in 25 words or less. He says, you know, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And if he wanted to say, we're all one, he would have said that. But what he did say is a famous passage, and he's in the forest with his monks. He picks up a handful of leaves, and he says, oh, monks, which is greater, the number of leaves in the forest or the number of leaves in my hand? And they say, well, obviously, Lord Buddha, it's the number of leaves in the forest. He says, just so. He says, the number of things that I know is so much greater than the number of which I'm teaching you. And the reason is that I'm only teaching you the things that you need to know to get free. So he left this big area. He said, you know, this can be true, but it's not useful. We're trying to think, oh, well, it's true or false, and if it's true, it's got to be useful. No, he made the further distinction, is it really useful? And, you know, things like, you know, whether we're all one or not, I mean, that may be in the true but not useful category. And generally, the Buddha was a very pragmatic and not necessarily a metaphysical kind of guy. He was... People would ask him questions, like he never said, I don't think he really said there was no soul, but he did say, don't pay attention to it, it's not a useful question. I mean, people would come to him and ask him questions, and he'd just, which they used to do in India a lot, is like, you know, go and talk to this guy from this sect and this guy, you know, go and quiz all the teachers and all that. He just would plain not answer. You know, people were trying to bait him and stuff, and he's like, and when people would ask about the self or something, he would bring folks back to the immediate experience. Like, if your leg's hurting, he'd say, this is not me, this in particular is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. So he did whatever he could do to point people gently back to their personal experience with the here and now, rather than concepts, no matter how nice they were, but whether concepts about no soul or all one or something like that, whether they're true or not, he just didn't find them useful. So I think that's the way that I understand the teachings.
Hi. You were talking about sleepiness.
Yes.
I'm a midlife parent to a one-year-old, so I'm fully sleepy.
Okay.
I've been meditating not consistently for years, and I've found my meditation practice has dramatically changed since my daughter was born last year, in that I start off, I'm using the mala beads and the breathing, and I can't differentiate. It's very pleasant at the end, and I'm not sure if I've gone into some meditation zone or if I've just gone into some sleepy zone. Tonight was a really good sit. I've had a number of really good sits here, and I'm not quite sure if I've just gone to sleep a little bit, or I'm here by myself, or so. I'm not. It's confusing me. I'm not sure if it's a good thing or if I'm sleeping.
Well.
Well,
actually, sleep may be better than spacing out. I mean, you know, there's I mean, having kids, that's just amazing. I can't really. I mean, I'm in awe of people. We had our nieces for 5 days, and I just couldn't believe how hard that was. And and what if we got them for 18 years? I just can't imagine that. But there's but meditation, concentration can make you relaxed and feel very pleasant. But that's half of it. The other half is if you have a relaxed alertness or an alert relaxation or something like that. So if the body gets relaxed, that's fine. And if the brain kind of, if the mind slows down, doesn't get jittery, that's good. But if the brain turns off and starts drifting, then that's probably either sleep or spacing out. And so if you're trying to do Vipassana, where you're trying to keep enough concentration so that the body is relaxed, the brain kind of quiets down, but there's still enough there to pay attention to the breath or the thoughts or something like that. That's kind of, I think that's still a balance we're looking for.
So if I feel myself drifting down, maybe pay attention to the breath again, bring it up a little bit, pay attention to the breath.
I would try that.
Here.
Yeah. You know, really, we all come from so many. We come from so many different meditation backgrounds, and for some places, just blissing out was great stuff, right? And then nobody told us that the rules had changed when we came to Vipassana. So we, right? So that's part of why I talked about this, because different meditative traditions, have different values and priorities. And so if you do TM, it's going to be quite a bit on the concentration thing. I've never done it, but it's quite a bit on the concentration thing, and maybe not so much in the mindfulness. So you may have another tradition in your background or something like that, where that was more valued. But in Vipassana, I think we still need to keep some. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's after 9. I want to thank you all for coming. Really enjoyed this. Thank you very much.